Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name's Alex DeBoer.
I'm Lyndon Wong.
I'm Adeline Ping.
And I'm Samuel Jones. It's Thursday, January 24th at 5:06 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkamedam-speaking Musqueam people. On today's show, we begin by learning about logging on old-growth forests on Vancouver Island. News Collective reporter Andy Ledman speaks with Western Canada Wilderness Committee employee James Davey about the intricacies of logging in the area of Carmenah-Woburn.
Then we turn to an impromptu interview with Franz Kursky of the UBC Men's Rights Association, a rejected AMS club. CRTR news reporter Samuel Jones had an impromptu interview with Kursky, which we will respond to with facts.
Lastly, we have a report on 3532 East Hastings, a rental housing project that was approved by City Council on January 15th. This project fell under the city's Rental 100 policy, which prioritizes the construction of rental supply in the city. We speak with Vancouver Tenants Union member Sarah Soggy and City Councilor Adrienne Carr about this Rental 100 policy and how affordability is and should be defined in Vancouver. Now for Andy's interview with James Davey on logging.
I'm not at the show today, unfortunately, so I wanted to give you a bit of a rundown on what's going on in this piece. It's about old-growth logging on Vancouver Island, specifically in the Carmenah-Woburn, and it is a follow-up piece to an interview we aired here on Democracy Watch on January 10th. I spoke with James Davey, who introduces himself in the piece. I won't give you too much of an introduction, but yeah, take a listen. Hi, James. Thanks for joining me. Can you tell me a bit about your work and what it is that makes you qualified to speak about the Carmenah-Woburn?
Well, first, thanks for having me on. Yeah, in terms of qualifications, been a canvasser, so a door-to-door fundraiser for an environmental charity, the Western Canada Wilderness Committee, for 4 years. And they're one of the groups who's been involved with the preservation of Carmenah back in the late 80s, early 90s, and has been working to try and protect the last of the Woburn pretty much since then. In addition to that, I'm also doing my master's thesis at the University of Victoria on environmental history, with my case study being the Carmenah-Woburn. So I am coming from it from an academic settler perspective, as well as sort of a urban middle-class environmentalist. It's kind of a strange question, I find, to like what makes me qualified to talk about it, because ultimately I really want to try and problematize the idea that someone can be more qualified to talk about an area like the Woburn, particularly as it's tied up in colonial displacement. For example, it's the traditional territory of the Patchidat and Quabadawa, which I think often gets overlooked in a lot of these debates.
And those are some really great points you raised, so I'm really glad that you brought up the historical aspect of it as well as the colonial. So do you just want to let us know where the Carmenah is and what its history with logging is?
So the Carmenah-Woburn is a series of river systems on southern Vancouver Island. Kind of tough to situate it because sort of in the middle of nowhere, like there aren't any major towns right next to it. That's kind of why it's been so attractive to sort of romanticize as both wilderness or as timber reserve. But the easiest way to situate it is it's by Port Renfrew, which is on the southwest coast of Vancouver Island. Essentially from Victoria, you drive along the coast until the road ends. You get to Port Renfrew, and then it's another hour or so on logging roads. And then to get to Carmenah, it's actually a different road on the other side, and you have to come from the north. So Bamfield is kind of the closest city there, but again, neither one of those are particularly close. The only way to get there is through logging roads, which is another irony of, you know, wilderness hikers to go there. And in terms of the history of logging, again, the fact that it's sort of at the end of the road in both these cases has made it really crucial, both for these timber communities who have often relied on it for a long time, sort of basing their logging plans on having that there to log, as well as for environmentalists. As that movement is really culminating, these are some of the few areas left with this temperate old-growth rainforest. So that's why it makes it, for me, really interesting as a historical subject, because before environmentalists really, quote-unquote, discover Carmenah, there's already sort of a moment of crisis in the logging community of Lake Cowichan, which is just inland from this area, and it's connected to the tree farm license that sort of governs this area. So they've been, you know, logging for about 50 years at this point. They've been replanting and sort of with this idea that second growth is going to be able to sustain the same amount of yield as old growth, which we now know is obviously not the case. So by the time, you know, 1988 rolls around and they find the Carmana giant and environmentalists really sort of find this icon in Carmana as something to preserve, it's really emerging at the, there's already this point of crisis in logging communities, on top of, you know, the history of, again, colonial displacement, which had been ongoing since the 19th century, but more particularly since about World War II when residential schools removed indigenous people from the area.
Part of the valley is actually protected as a provincial park, and then part of it's not, leaving it vulnerable to logging. What actions on the governmental, on the activists, the watchdog arenas with indigenous efforts are currently being taken today to expand the protected areas?
Right. So the Carmana Valley is to the west, and that is actually entirely preserved as a park and has been so for almost 25 years now. So the entire watershed's protected. It was taken out of the tree farm license owned by the logging company McMillan Bloedel. They were compensated, I think, over $100 million by the provincial government to sort of, you know, buy the logging rights away from them. But the wall brand was a bit more convoluted. So the wall brand was actually licensed by two different companies. So part of it was McMillan Bloedel and part of it was this New Zealand-based company, Fletcher Challenge. So the entirety of the McMillan Bloedel part is part of the park, but the central wall brand, which was licensed by Fletcher Challenge, is still unprotected. And the irony of that is that's actually where the majority of the protests were back in 1991. And there's a particular bridge across the Walbrand Creek, which was the site of many blockades involving about 30 arrests of protesters. So the central Walbrand is still unprotected despite parts of the Walbrand being a park. That's where a lot of the confusion is among people. As I said, I'm a door-to-door canvasser, and it's amazing how many people I've talked to are really sort of shocked when I say, oh, we're trying to protect the Walbrand, and they say, I thought it was already a park. So in fact, it was changed into a special management zone, which has, you know, restrictions on smaller clear cuts. It has, you have to be further distance away from riparian zones, and there's certain regulations against ecosystem fragmentation. But ultimately, the goal is to turn a natural forest into a tree farm. That's why protests are ongoing today. You know, estimates range from about 5 to 10% of this kind of ecosystem remaining, that being low elevation temperate rainforest old growth on Vancouver Island. Basically, they're important for recreation. People like to go visit these areas. It's really sort of aesthetically beautiful. It's also sort of, to risk sounding too much like an emotional environmentalist, there is the, you know, spiritual feeling you get when you're there that you can't quite put your finger on, but it's pretty magical once you've driven an hour through clear cuts to get there and you're among 2,000-year-old trees. But beyond that, there's endangered species there. The famous one is the marbled murrelet, which is a seabird that only nests in old-growth forest. The first nests in Canada were found in the upper Walbrand, which led to that being protected. But on top of that, there's also been hundreds of different species found in treetop canopies of this area of different arthropods. They're the same genus as scorpions, which sort of points to the fact that we really don't know a lot about these areas, and old growth in particular keeps revealing new information that we didn't recognize, and of course didn't know for the 75 years that logging has been ongoing, that sort of minimizes these into, you know, numbers on a page that are in harvest plans. For example, there's a really amazing book that came out called The Hidden Life of Trees that showed old growth forests have certain relationships with mycelium fungus in the soil, which actually transmits nutrients among trees. They can actually send messages back and forth, which also helps old growth forests grow a lot stronger and produce more fiber than second growth, which just doesn't have those kind of networks that take so long to develop. So there's really, you know, countless different reasons why ecosystems like this are important. And that's before you're even talking about how much carbon it sequesters out of the atmosphere and helps combat climate change. They also don't burn as easily as second growth forests because there's more moisture retained in the undergrowth, which you don't get in second growth. So one of the main things I always try and convey is that the rhetoric about sharing these places is really sort of disingenuous when, you know, the vast majority of the province has already been cut down. Few areas remain.
And something that you kind of touched on is something that we actually discussed last week on the show, is that there seems to be a general awareness about the severity of the logging on Vancouver Island. I know you mentioned when you were canvassing, a lot of people didn't seem to be aware, but do you think that it's a fair assessment that not a lot of people are aware of it? And why do you think this is?
Yeah, I would say that the vast majority of people are unaware, and I think the big reason for that is it's tough to get there. It's an hour on logging road. If you don't have a 4x4 or don't know the way, it's sort of inaccessible, which is why I think a big goal of a lot of environmental groups is to make it more accessible. So in particular, one of the main things that Wilderness Committee has done for a long time is build trails in there to try and make it so that people can go and actually check out these areas and see what it's all about. Because it's one thing to talk about thousand-year-old trees in the abstract. It's a total another one when you're there in person.
Sorry, just to confirm, that's a nonprofit that's building those trails there.
Yeah, so it's a charity nonprofit, and it's actually entirely legal because it's Crown land. Provincial land, public has access to it for recreation. The company owns the right to harvest trees. To respond to your question of, you know, why people know so little about this, I think it's sort of an apathy around this. People either think that all the old growth is already going to be cut down, there's nothing we can do about it, or alternatively, it's already saved. What's the point? I thought that was already dealt with in the 90s. So I think that there's just not quite the same interest about it. In the last provincial election, it was not even really an issue for any of the political parties. The NDP sort of released something at the very end of the campaign, briefly mentioning it, but not really addressing it. And I think part of the reason for that is because it is such a touchy subject, especially in the context of forest worker layoffs, which is very real and awful problem for a lot of these communities who have relied on the forest for so long and have their mills shut down. And I think that a big part of the solution needs to include workers and environmentalists as well as Indigenous people and think about local sustainable solutions to these problems and understand that raw log exports are another big part of the problem, not necessarily in the wall brand, but just in terms of understanding how our economy works, understanding how much more sustainable ecotourism is in the long run. And I think that's really another fundamental aspect of the trail building is to try and provide jobs that are going to last in perpetuity and, you know, have that money actually stay in these communities. And I always like to use the example of, you know, Tofino versus Lake Cowichan. One place preserved their forest, tourist hub, another one cut them all down, and not a lot of people want to come from all over the world to hike through a second growth clear cut.
So kind of tying into that as well is, you know, CITR is located on the Lower Mainland, so we're not on Vancouver Island. I was wondering what kind of actions can we here on the Lower Mainland, but in general, take to educate ourselves more about this issue, as well as what we can do to help prevent further logging in the area?
In terms of education, I mean, what's really interesting is that the information is out there. Like, there are several nonprofit organizations who have done a ton of work publicizing this. Like, I'm obviously, you know, talking about the Wilderness Committee, but the Ancient Forest Alliance has done a lot of great work. The Sierra Club of BC has done a ton of great work and publicizing this stuff. So, you know, really just educating yourself about what's going on and beyond, you know, tangibly trying to go out there and, you know, build trails and help out with that kind of thing. Just writing letters to MLAs and sort of voicing your opinion saying, you know, I want to preserve old growth forests, I think is really powerful. And people often underestimate the impact of certain measures like that. I think that's, you know, a really great way to help out. I mean, that's the other sort of fun way to do it that's totally free is just, you know, go camp and explore these areas and bring people out there. That's really what I find is the most fundamental way that people's consciousness has changed, because I've yet to meet the person who's gone out there and not sort of been totally convinced that this area needs to be stopped from logging. These thousand-year-old trees shouldn't be turned into shingles and 2x4s. I guess I should mention one more thing, that I think that it's really important to understand how infrequently the sort of fundamental basis of the tree farm licensing is. Like, for example, when it was first granted in 1955, the Minister of Forest was jailed for bribery related to granting the license. The first MLA in the British Commonwealth jailed for that. And despite the conviction, the license stayed with the company. So sort of recognizing who's actually profiting off this sort of thing, and understanding that workers, environmentalists, Indigenous people need to work together on thinking of alternate solutions, alternate methods of, you know, selective forestry, in addition to ecotourism, to try and think beyond these sort of systems that we think are immutable and can't change, but they actually are.
Thank you so much for speaking with me about this really important issue.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
And that was James Davey sharing some of his knowledge with us concerning old growth logging on Vancouver Island, specifically in the Carmana Wildbrand. If you want to learn more about that fun fact that James shared with us concerning the MLA that was jailed, his name is Robert Summers. All right, thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM.
There's only one One way that old clunker is going to make you feel good again, donate it to Bullying Canada. Check this out, free towing or pickup of your old vehicle, a tax-deductible receipt, and a super easy process, online at bullyingcanada.ca. Get rid of that old vehicle and feel good about supporting real solutions for change in your community. Donate your old or used vehicle to Bullying Canada today. Full details online at bullyingcanada.ca.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smokey every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or f*** with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
And we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9. Thanks for tuning in.
So, would you mind introducing yourself and why you're here today?
Sure. My name is Franz Kurtzky. I am a fourth-year standing philosophy major here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Well, I put up an information table for the UBC Men's Rights Association for the first time, and there was a very high level of interest.
So, I saw Franz talking to the RCMP outside the student nest on my way into the studio one day. He had set up a booth with a large red banner that read out MRA, Men's Rights Association. He was just packing up, but I decided to take the opportunity to interview him about his position as a men's rights activist to see what all this fuss was about exactly.
So what are your grievances as a men's rights activist exactly?
So as a men's rights activist, I currently have 7 ongoing anti-male discrimination claims at the University of British Columbia, very soon, including the AMS. Very soon, that's going to be 8 discrimination claims. Depends how long I take to draft it. Very briefly, I don't know if I'll remember all of them. UBC has been majority female on the undergraduate level for about 30 years. And on the graduate level, I believe, for about 20 years. Nationally, about 6 out of 10 students are female now. UBC is almost 56% female. Females outnumber males by over 6,000 people at UBC. That's all very important information as I describe these claims very briefly for a little bit of context.
So, even though there are more female undergraduate and graduate students, the people who actually hold the positions of power in the university are overwhelmingly male.
Right, and I think that's such an important fact to mention. So the latest stats are actually quite sobering. And the last time the university did a full report, 80% of full-time profs were male. So that's, you know, full-time rather than just sessional or part-time. So let's go to another clip.
So one is women are still receiving gender exclusive scholarships in 2019, even though they are the majority and have been the majority apparently for decades at this university. So I filed a claim about that. Some of you might have heard about 50-50 by 2020 in the engineering department. They have a program to attempt to have 50% female engineering students by the year 2020. And this encouragement program, I believe, also includes women in engineering. I don't know if that's the name. Some kind of incentive scholarships worth up to perhaps $10,000 apiece to encourage people to become engineers. Now, there's a bit of a logical problem there because the school is only about 44% male, and we are trying to get 50% female engineers while not really caring about the fact that the school is less than 50% men. There's no 50-50 by 2020 program for UBC, nor is there any similar program as 50-50 by 2020 in engineering for men in any other female-dominated department, of which there are plenty.
So I would point out, just to respond to his statements here, a study published in September of 2018 in the U.S. National Bureau of Economics found that women were 12% less likely to graduate from a doctoral program in 6 years than men if they had no female peers in their cohort. So that kind of commenting on female-to-female support and probably feelings of safety and, like, gendered experience understandings. And this effect was even greater in the science, technology, engineering, and math disciplines, which includes, as I mentioned, engineering. So, yeah.
So there are several others, I'm sorry. The new sexual assault policy at UBC is also facing a discrimination claim, something that may be shocking to people hearing this. Back in 2014, the largest anti-sexual violence organization in the United States, RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, they wrote a letter to a White House task force basically criticizing the idea of a campus rape culture narrative. This report is not difficult to find. I think Time wrote about it. Caroline Kitchens might be a name you can Google. But basically, I'm very concerned that UBC is having an ideologically based policy for dealing with sexual assault, which is not based on rigorous social science. There are also multiple other concerning issues around substance use and consent, which I think is too vague. Some issues with cross-examination rights, right to a lawyer might potentially be an issue. There's a whole lot of things. Shall I continue?
I think I wanted to ask you just a question.
There's a lot of material, right?
You have a lot to say. And I wonder if a part of having a lot to say isn't a bit of a way to curb the negative responses with a bit of an information dump. Do you have arguments that are a back and forth, or do you tend to sort of throw this information out at people? How do you tend to engage?
So, as you heard, I did mention to Franz that he was a little long-winded, and I did wonder if it was because I'm a reporter or because that's how he engages with everyone. He does, however, simply believe himself to be at an information advantage from what he says here.
That's an excellent question and an interesting angle. Let me put it this way. I don't think that there were any arguments that really spun my head around tonight. And I talked to a lot of people. I was exposed to a lot of people. Thankfully, I've really done my homework. Now, it is difficult sometimes because I'm at a little bit of an information advantage in some respects.
Now, we need a lawyer to obviously discuss the claims that he's making in regards to this law program at UBC and the veracity of what he's saying regarding the process he's critiquing here. So we'll move on to the couple of points he's trying to make.
The Rise Women's Legal Center, UBC helped co-found this center, I think, a few years ago. It's a family law-focused clinic, and people who know that, for example, men are less likely to get custody of children, these type of things, would find it probably shocking to know that UBC is running its law students through this program, apparently, which is excluding men from applying for legal aid. So that's another claim that I've filed.
Research that we have, what Franz is missing here seems to be that Section 15 of the Charter and provincial human rights law also has protection for certain programs, laws, etc., that have as their goal the amelioration of disadvantage experienced by groups.
Right. So these provisions amount to protections for affirmative action type programs or policies or laws even that are meant to provide, for example, women-only spaces and programs which are warranted to address existing discrimination rather than to themselves discriminate. So there's a long history, obviously, an ongoing legacy of professions, clubs, programs that exclude women or are dominated by men with barriers to women's participation, which is essentially another form of exclusion. So the short answer is that a men's group would be treated differently in law than a women's group. And there are historical and current legal reasons for that.
Yeah, there's a lot, you know, we could get into here. As mm-hmm. I mentioned in my interview with Franz, he has a lot to say, and we didn't have time to get into all the arguments he made, nor all the facts that refute them. But a fact that's important to remember is, you know, that it would be difficult, because of what you just said, for a discrimination case to be filed. to win out against UBC on behalf of men, just due to the historical issues going on, due to the sort of the society at large that we live in. UBC, you know, despite having 56% of students, you know, being female, is a microcosm of our society. It's one place.
Yeah, absolutely. That's key to keep in mind. Well, thanks for that interview, Sam.
We're
going to go to a short break. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. When we come back, we have some municipal government reporting on a housing policy that was passed on January 15th and how the City of Vancouver defines affordable housing. So definitely stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
All right, and we are back. You're listening to Democracy Watch, which is CITR's News Collective's weekly news show. And we have been hearing some local news. We heard about some logging on Vancouver Island, which is, you know, local in the larger sense. But we felt it was really important to cover because, honestly, there's been very little coverage of it in the media. Reporter Andy Laidman did an interview on that to kind of bring that to light a little bit. And then we also had kind of a, I don't want to say a fun piece, but an interesting piece that Sam, who's in studio with me now, did with a men's rights activist and just had some kind of factual rebuttals to his sort of claims of reverse sexism.
He, in fairness, never used that term.
But that's literally exactly,
literally
exactly what he's claiming. So anyway, just a little thing, just a little piece to add to the show. So now we've been working really hard on an episode of Seeking Office, which I'm sure, as you all know, is our municipal politics podcast. However, though we have been like hustling today, we did not finish the piece, so we weren't able to air it. But we are still going to talk about our story, which I'll explain in a second. And then we're going to play an interview that I did today with Councillor Adrian Carr. So the story is that on January 15th, Samuel Jones and Lyndon Wong, who are in studio with me, went down to City Council to hear about two housing proposals that were put in front of council. So do you guys want to tell me what those two projects were? I know one was a seniors house, a senior center, rather. I think it was Harrison Drive.
Yes, a seniors.
Yeah, 2230 Harrison Drive, as I'm sure.
Harrison Drive.
Yeah.
And 3532 East Hastings. So the first project at Harrison Drive I have East Hastings pulled up right now, so I'll just talk.
Yeah, go for
about
that one.
That one's
sort of the one that got more attention.
It is, definitely. And it is the more controversial one.
Right.
So the City of Vancouver sort of like was processing this application of a building that currently has 8 units, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And the rents range and the rents range from $650 to $800 about. And so there the talk essentially with the developer, they want to build a 35 market rental unit building. And this building essentially would end up the tenants currently there, they would have some compensation for the building is being developed. They would be receiving about 2 months rent and 2 to 3 months of rent. And sort of they would cover moving expenses, that sort of stuff. And they would receive a 20% cut on the rent of the new units and the right of first refusal. So they get asked first. If they say no, whatever, but they get first priority.
Okay, so just to like do a quick overview in case people are just tuning in. So we're talking about a rental project located at 3532 East Hastings, which is on Hastings, like right beside the P&E, really close to the Burnaby boundary with Vancouver. This is, as you said, Sam, a small apartment building which currently only has 8 units, and the rents there currently are like extremely cheap. So they range from 600 to what, 800?
Yeah.
And there's like single bedroom to 3-bedroom or single and 2-bedroom. Anyway, small, you know, apartment units. And so there's a company that proposed to develop this and turn it into 32 units, you said?
Yeah, 34 units.
So that's a huge increase. So they're making it, and they're doing that by height. So they're adding, it's going to be 6 stories rather than probably it's 2 or something right now. I'm not actually sure. But adding height to it nonetheless. And so in making this proposal to the city, the policies in place mandate that the developer has to give tenants 2 months rent. Is that?
Yes, 2 to 3 months. I think there is
notice. That is notice.
Sorry?
Like 2 to 3 months notice that they'll have to leave their suites for the building to be
essentially
torn down, mm-hmm. I imagine. Okay. And then did you mention that the company was also offering, as sort of like a goodwill gesture, right of first?
Yes,
well, I think they
yes.
actually legally have to now give right of first return, right?
Refusal, as it's called, I think.
Right of first refusal.
Yes,
is that legally based on the Gene Swanson motion passed in December?
I believe so. However, they may have been grandfathered in from rental 100.
No, it was grandfathered in from rental 100.
Yeah,
but
I mean
that's
that particular policy, though.
Oh, like it might not apply? Anyway,
right.
Whatever. Let's not talk about this since we obviously aren't sure. Yeah, but anyway, so the building itself, this rental development building passed. Do you want to talk about, so it passed, as you said, under a rental policy that was put in place by the Vision government in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And this housing policy is called Rental 100. Yeah, do you want to talk about what that is?
Yeah, so the Rental 100 policy is essentially a policy that seeks to incentivize developers to build mm-hmm. rental units. So as it stands right now, developers, it's much more lucrative to build condominiums because you can then sell those condominiums. You make much more profit than all at once, right? Than you mm-hmm. would necessarily make renting out a unit. It'll take years to recoup your losses on the building and the project itself compared to condominiums. And so there's incentives that Rental 100 has to sort of get into the basics, the incentives that involve the waivings of fees. I'm not really sure what particular fees are waived, but a significant amount of them. And it is basically to increase rental supply in the city. That is the goal of
right.
the Rental 100 program.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally. So it passed under that policy. But there was some critique of that, and you two interviewed Sarah Sagai of the Vancouver Tenants Union. I think she's a steering committee member, and we will have that interview in our episode of Seeking Office. But for now, maybe Lyndon, did you want to summarize what Sarah's critiques were?
yeah, like the main problems with this Renter 100 is that the price drop that they give as a part of this program from city council is just not enough to cover their rent, because of the significant rise in price.
So you're referring to the right of first refusal, yeah. right? The 20% cut on the rent that the new units would be?
Yes. Yeah. It's just too high because of the price difference between the old building and the new one. And because you are sacrificing affordability for more supply.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that there are also issues with how they address and how they alert these former renters and tenants of the rent evictions. Because basically, I do believe the responsibility does fall on the developers and the landlords to alert the former tenants that these rezonings are happening. So it can lead to a lot of misinformation and, basically opens up for a lot of misuse, and so that they're not aware of their full rights because they're not fully, because they're not fully told, and people are afraid of speaking out as well.
Yeah, Sarah mentioned that she didn't want to mention specifically. She sort of stifled herself when she was about to say the name
mm-hmm.
of a tenant from this building she spoke to
mm-hmm.
because, you know, you've got the landlord in the room. You've got the developers right. in the room, right? And they themselves, and, you know, I asked Sarah about this, like, why the concern there? And sort of what was expressed to me was that the reason for this concern is that they themselves have said, like, I don't want the landlord, the developers, city council, I don't want this on the public record that I feel this way and
right.
that I'm speaking out about this, because they are afraid. I'm sure for them personally, the fears are probably feeling quite warranted. They're in very vulnerable positions, as Sarah has expressed. Some of them have been rent evicted before. Some of them are living paycheck to paycheck. They have issues. Yeah. They're hanging on, and to have more obstacles in the way in the form of a landlord and intimidating you or anything, I'm sure is a very frightening prospect.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And so when I spoke with Adrian Carr a few hours ago about this Rental 100 policy. We talked about some of the things you mentioned, like, Lyndon, you mentioned the city having to tell tenants about their rights when they're in a situation where they're being evicted. And this is now actually mandated based on a motion passed in council in December, which was tabled by Gene Swanson. So we talked about that a little bit. And we also talked about Adrian Carr's perspective on Rental 100 as a housing policy, which, as you said, incentivizes the building of rental, and it runs on this theory that if we simply have more rental, which is cheaper than condos, then that's sort of good enough. It's making the city more affordable. But then the kind of critique of that Sarah from the VTU is making, and that Adrian Carr herself makes, is that that's actually not necessarily good enough. And having, you know, mixed units that have different costs, like some at market value, some for low income people, that might not be enough. And that might not be enough to define that building as affordable housing. Right. So it's interesting to think about how pushing back on definitions is meaningful, because when we just use words and they're kind of like, maybe they don't mean what their definition says. I mean, it just kind of takes all the power out of them. And so maybe we need a kind of more diverse range of phrasing or words to define, like, different types of housing in the city, because the term affordable is really being used really ubiquitously. And I think Adrian Carr talks about how that's problematic. So did you want to say something?
Oh, yeah. Well, I would definitely comment that I think the on-the-street definition, like, if you were to ask a regular person, hey, what do you think is an affordable one-bedroom apartment? It would not be sort of what we're seeing, which is $1,500, somewhere close to there, I think.
Yeah, I think the literal definition of affordable is something that's inexpensive or reasonably priced for, like, the average person.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're right.
This is just not adding up to the definition.
Definitely.
But I'm just conscious of the time. So let's go to this interview with Councillor Adrian Carr and hear what she has to say. Here we go. All right. Are you able to hear me?
I can.
Excellent. Thank you. So thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. I was wondering if you could start out by just telling our listeners who you are.
Adrian Carr, City Councillor, City of Vancouver.
Excellent, thanks. So on January 15th, a rental project was passed at 3532 East Hastings, And the policy, the rental policy that it was passed under is called Rental 100. That's an abbreviation for a longer policy title. But I was wondering if you could tell us what Rental 100 is.
Oh, Rental 100 is a policy in the city of Vancouver that's intended to entice developers into building rental housing as opposed to condos. And so what it does is offer developers who produce housing that's 100% rental waivers for the financial incentives in the form of waivers of development cost levy charges to the tune overall of in the millions of dollars that are for them built, that basically is a incentive for them to build the rental housing. But that housing, there's a problem with it from my point of view, but that in order to get those waivers, they have to reach housing that is at a maximum amount of rent. But that maximum rental charges are, in fact, basically market rents. So they are very high rents, which has a lot of people, especially myself, over the last number of years, very concerned.
Right. Because this policy passed in 2012, and as an incumbent councillor, did you vote against it then?
That's right.
Okay.
I was not supportive of that policy. I was not supportive, and I have continued to ask for that policy to be changed. I've tried to get it changed so that instead of money or development cost levies being waived for apartments that are at market rent, to change that so that they're only waived if the rents come in at what is truly affordable for people. And my suggestion had been 30% of a renter's income, which is sort of the standard definition of affordability, 30% of people's income. So, but I could never get that changed under the previous council.
And aren't these the rents that are being set at this new project defined as affordable as by that definition of 30% of income?
No, they're not.
They're not.
This project is still under the old Rental 100 program, which means that they're in the range of market rents, and those are all outlined in the DCL bylaws, and it's adjusted annually by statistics gathered by the Canada Housing Mortgage Corporation. So, you know, that does follow market rent. So they are, in my mind, way beyond what average households can pay, especially average renter households, and in East Van in particular, where this project is located.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so the definition that Rental 100 follows is different than the 30% of a person's income as affordable, which you're talking about as being, you know, more representative of the term affordable. But previously, the standard in Rental 100 was still considered affordable, right? Isn't it called affordable market housing?
Yes, and I've for the last 7 years I've been on council, and I have continued to question why we are calling it affordable and asking that word be struck out of our records. And I've never had success over the last 7 years because of, you know, the Vision-dominated council is just not being interested in seeing that change. But the reason why they call it affordable, it's sort of a joke in my mind. It's because it's being compared to the cost of owning a home. So you'll see in any of the reports that come to council where it talks about the rents that are proposed for this project, for a particular project, where it, you know, it lists the DCL waiver levels, which are basically market rents. Sometimes it'll list what the average rent is going for in the neighborhood, which is usually less than the CMHC rents. And then it'll have the last column, which says the cost of owning a home in this neighborhood in terms of a monthly mortgage. So that's how the previous council used to define affordability. Well, it would cost you more to own, so as long as it's less than the cost to own, it's affordable.
Right. And then I'm wondering, with this project, it was seen under the policy of Rental 100, even though this is a new council, because the project was applied for previous to this council being elected. Is that correct? So sort of grandfathered in?
It was applied for. Yeah, it was basically applied for. Yes, it was. The application came in prior to this council being elected, but it also came in under, obviously, the current guidelines, policies, and bylaws.
Okay. I guess what I'm wondering is now if someone were to submit a development application for a rental-only project, would it be under Rental 100, or is the council revising that policy?
You know, I can tell you that by the discussion that occurred at the public hearing around this item, that there's every intention for this council to revise the DCL bylaw and the Rental 100 policies. There was considerable concern over the fact that the people who are going to be displaced by this new project, there are 8 units of housing there, that the people are paying rents that are extraordinarily reasonable. And the chance of them finding decent housing at that kind of rent is near to impossible within Vancouver. So there are people, including myself, who are very concerned about that. And although I have to say it's also incumbent upon us as councillors to also understand that when a developer applies under the current rules and follows all of the rules and policies and bylaws in particular, it's rather incumbent, I think, to say, okay, they followed those rules. I don't like the rules, but and I've been trying to change them, but they follow those rules, and it's unfair to say no to the project. However, I am determined to see those rules changed, and so happy that there's enough colleagues on the council that I think that those rules will get changed and will get changed very quickly.
Right. And how much do you think the Housing Vancouver Strategy Council adopted sort of plays into this problem, though, because the goal of that policy is to build 72,000 new homes in the next 10 years. And so there's sort of this emphasis on supply versus maybe what is truly affordable. So there's all this pressure to build, but not the mechanisms in place to make them affordable.
Right. So the difference about the Housing Vancouver policy and strategy, and the reason I voted for it, is because for the first time in a major policy around housing in the city of Vancouver, it talked about something called the right supply. Mm. And by that, it defined the right supply as supply of housing where the cost of housing should be equal to no more than 30% of a household income. I have been fighting to get that into words in our policy documents, as I say, for every year I've been on council. And so I was so happy to actually finally see that land into a document, but it hasn't translated yet into all the bylaw changes, like the DCL bylaw change. So I then fought to get that happen, but it didn't. But I think that it will now. And certainly the debate at council, I've heard that through the sort of the social media chat lines that there were a lot of developers watching that debate over that issue when it came up at the at public hearing. And they are taking note that this council is very different than the previous council and is going to do something to change the way in which we offer incentives for the building of rental. We still want rental. Rental is incredibly important in this city, but it has to be affordable rental or else it's, you know, or what's the use, really? And especially foregoing multi-millions worth of development cost levies.
Right. And just so I understand correctly what you just said, so like the Housing Vancouver strategy that council has taken on to build all this new supply, it has the 30% of an income set as the standard for what is affordable, but what needs to be changed now to make that apply to all projects in front of council is the bylaws.
That's right.
Right.
The bylaws.
Okay.
And the incentive programs like Rental 100. But Rental 100 is tied to the DCL bylaw. So if we change that DCL bylaw to make it match.
Can you explain what that is for our listeners?
Okay. The DCL bylaw is the Development Cost Levy bylaw. So it's the bylaw that states how much different units of housing should rent for in order to qualify a developer for getting a waiver on the development cost charges. So and so that's an incentive for a developer to build rental. And right, so DCL refers to development cost levy. And every project is charged a development cost levy in the city. But to try and entice development of rental, there's this program, Rental 100, which allows a developer to apply for a waiver of those development cost levies. And in order to get that, they have to look to that bylaw, and then they'll see that they have to make sure their rents are that they're charging will be no more than the rent specified in that bylaw. So the big thing is to change the rents that are specified in that bylaw to what is truly affordable. That's, and then the second, actually a second piece is also in my mind, making sure that the developer then actually applies those rents, that there's not an uplift to the rents after they get the project built or after the first person moves out. So I want to see some security around truly affordable rents over the long term as well.
Right. And I mean, that sort of ties into my next question, which was that in December, council passed a motion, which Councillor Swanson tabled, which is to provide greater protection to renters. And one of the aspects of that motion was that the city must now provide tenants in rental buildings with the information about their rights. So I'm just wondering, like, in the case of 3532 East Hastings, did the city reach out to the tenants and let them know their rights in this situation?
Yeah. That's now required.
Okay, but it wasn't required for this rental because it was grandfathered in under the Rental 100 policy?
Oh, that's a very good question. I would think that because when we finally passed the project, it was after Councillor Swanson's motion, that it would be incumbent upon our staff to make sure that the renters are informed. But also, our staff are intending to reach out to them regardless, because part of the discussion around that project was to ensure that the renters, our staff are going to try and find subsidies for them to be able to get them into housing that is commensurate with their incomes.
Oh, okay. So this is that like formalized somewhere?
Well, it was only in the discussion.
Okay.
It was a commitment on the part of staff. During that debate.
Okay, so I'm just curious. I didn't know about that. So there's going to be an effort by city staff to, as you said, help relocate these folks to affordable housing units?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, great. And then I just had one other question, which is that an alternative to Rental 100 that was brought up by Councillor Swanson was to possibly have rental-only zoning. I'm wondering if you see that as a viable alternative?
Yeah, I really want staff to come back with more information on it and how it would work, and their projections of how it would dampen or depress the increasing land values that are really the driving force behind unaffordability in the city. And so my expectation is that by creating a zone that is you can only build rental in, that people will not pay as much money for it. They pay huge amounts of money for land when they think that they can develop it into luxury condos that then they can make a killing on in terms of profit. But if they know that that can't happen and the land can only be used for rental housing if it's multifamily that you want to develop, then I think the land prices will go down and the actual cost of housing will then go down. So I'd like to see that analysis. But in general, I'm supportive of the whole idea of zoning for rental housing as a means to be able to achieve greater affordability.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Councillor Carr. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for those were great questions. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay.
Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Our show is coming to a close. That was an interview I conducted with Green Councillor Adrian Carr. And yeah, that's it for the show today. I want to thank you for listening and bearing with us at the beginning with our late start. We had some tech difficulties in the studio. We wanted to let people know how they can find us on social media as well. So you can find us on Facebook. We're called The News Collective. And then our podcast, Seeking Office, also has a Facebook page, so you can find it there. We're pretty active on Twitter, so if you want to check us out there, that's a good idea. Our Twitter handle is at CITR News. And then a couple of our reporters have handles as well. So Samuel Jones has at Sam Jones CITR. And then Lyndon's is Lyndon SHK Wong. And then mine, Alex DeBoer, is Alex M. DeBoer. So it's DEBOER. Yeah, so thanks for listening. And we will have an episode of Seeking Office out tonight, if I can, you know, push myself to do that. But most likely out tonight or tomorrow. So please check out Seeking Office on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. Subscribe. If you want to leave us a rating, that would be sweet. Like 5 stars, or like you could write something that you like it. If you like it. Yeah. So again, thank you very much for listening. Up next on CITR is either Flashback with Alec Christensen or No Dead Air. Not sure which show they're rotating. So keep listening to CITR, and we'll be back next week. Thank you.